afternoon, everybody. Hello and welcome back to Generation Climate, the GCE podcast. My name is Laura Locke and I'm the COP28 strategy lead at GCE. And today I'm really looking forward to speaking to Jessica and Marion about their experiences of SB58 and some of the key topics to look out for on the road to COP. SB58 occurred in Bonn, Germany, and sought to set the agenda for COP28 taking place later this year in the UAE. We'll be covering everything from the battles to finalise the COP agenda to the need for intergenerational equity and diving into some of the most contentious outcomes of the conference. So, to briefly introduce our two guests, we've got Marion and Jessica, who are both GCE team members. Marion is currently a part of the COP28 team as a networking and outreach project officer, and he works with WWF Romania as a communications and youth engagement specialist, and he's a freelance writer. He initially got engaged in climate diplomacy with Youth and Environment Europe last year, where he was a COP27 delegate focusing on mitigation and food security. Jessica works as an advocacy lead on intergenerational justice with GCE and is an active campaigner on international development issues ranging from climate justice to economic reform. She campaigns with World's Youth Climate Justice to bring the world's biggest problem to the highest court to get an advisory opinion on climate change. She served as the head of the EU delegation to the Y7 and the official engagement group to the G7 and COP27, recently attending the SB58 sessions. Thank you both so much for accepting our invitation, and I'm really, really looking forward to the discussion. So to sort of kick it off, I think it would be helpful to set the scene with sort of what actually is SB58. I think a lot of people have a very strong understanding of what COP is, but how would you explain SB58 to someone with absolutely sort of no knowledge at all?
Yes, let me take a stab at that. First of all, thanks very much also for having us. Really looking forward to this discussion. So the SB58 is also known as the intersessionals, the session in between COP. They take place at a halfway point, and they cover the sessions of the subsidiary bodies, the SBs. There are two. One is the subsidiary body for scientific and technological advice. People also say SUBSTA. And the subsidiary body for implementation, so SBI. And basically, the SBs are 2 weeks full of negotiations, work programs, meetings on topics or agenda items that fall under these two jurisdictions. And there are also a lot of side events, a lot of group meetings that take place. And the SB sessions are always in Bonn. They hold more room for technical expertise. And then from here on up to COP, things will get a lot more political. The SB sessions are also covered in the first week of COP, and then in the second week they call in the ministers to really hash out the details. So that's the SBs for you.
Hi everyone, Marianne here. I'm also going to jump in and say, just to add to what Jessica said earlier, that at COP, usually the COPs are also within a governing structure. They are the highest power. So the SBs, during those 2 weeks, we have, as Jessica said, more technical stuff, but then the big decisions and everything happens at COP, because this is where the Conference of Parties meet. Conference of Parties of the Convention, of the Kyoto Protocol, and of the Paris Agreement, they all meet during the COPs and they take decisions based on the developments that happen during the whole year.
Brilliant. Thank you so much for that introduction. So Jessica, to move on to your work a little bit, a lot of what you do at GCE and beyond is focused on intergenerational equity. And so to start with, I mean, what do you think the UNFCCC is actually doing at the moment to meaningfully engage young people while continuing to build this intergenerational aspect?
I think that is a really, really great question. So the UNFCCC process can be used, in my opinion, in two ways to promote intergenerational equity and justice. You mentioned them a little bit. So the first is youth participation in the process. And the second would be including youth rights in the conclusions that the parties actually take and the policies that they're going to take forward. And it would describe intergenerational justice and equity in the same way. So we need to make sure that young people have a say in the current decision-making process, especially when it comes to issues like climate change, because they will impact us the longest, for the longest time, and also the hardest. And we need to make sure that we, and then I mean more the international community, need to make sure that the policies that we are putting in place will not harm future generations. And we can no longer push today's problems onto the next group. So the UNFCCC process allows youth participation mostly through Youngal, one of the constituencies, the children and youth constituency. A lot more can be done in terms of access, in terms of funding, financial support, and facilitating participation in quite a technical process as well. We can observe that participation, depending on your background, can be easier or quite hard. So we have seen a lot of visa issues, for example, and we can see that getting funding or getting access to these platforms is harder for people coming from lower income countries. And we know that this is especially important because these countries are also hit harder by climate change. And so there is a lot to gain there still. And also, as I explained, the UNFCCC process can have an impact by mentioning intergenerational justice in the policies that they agree on. So this can be super top line, like including the 1.5 degree limit and ensuring that we don't warm up the planet more, but also specifically mentioning the vulnerability of young people and the implications on coming generations. Yeah, I'll stop there.
Brilliant, thank you. Just to sort of push that a little bit further, I mean, so we've seen that there's this inequity between generations, but taking that onto the global stage, obviously climate change is an issue with massive inequities. So how do you see these kind of international sort of geopolitics inequities as impacting the UNFCCC processes? You know, are the negotiations heavily politicized? Are they able to stay away from that? Sort of what's the significance of that? And what is the impact of that on our potential for sort of taking action on climate change?
I think the UNFCCC process is a mini version of the international geopolitics and inequity, as you stated. So we know that climate change is caused by an excess of greenhouse gas emissions. This situation has only been made possible because the so-called global north countries, so European countries, but also North American countries, have colonized large parts of the world, have extracted resources, exploited populations in order to industrialize their own countries, and in doing so emitted the vast majority of greenhouse gas and of emissions. And so here, for example, looking at the entire continent of Africa, less than 4% of global emissions are coming from there. And high-income historic emitters such as the US, EU countries, China, therefore carry a responsibility to fix the mess that they have essentially caused. And on top of that, we know that we can see the biggest effects of climate change hitting the lower-income countries more. And they have done little to create this situation. We know that our global economy, our capitalist system, the politics of borders, of visas, all these things are keeping this system that we put in place as the status quo. We know that the standard of living, so to say, in higher income countries is only possible because of this. And we know that it's by design. So this is done on purpose. And then you turn to these negotiations, our only international chance to tackle climate change. And then you see countries negotiate over who should pay and who should get actually that money and who should limit their emissions and by how much. And it doesn't add up. It defies sort of the science and the history that you know is there. But it is the only international platform that we have to hash out these details. And so we need to keep putting the pressure on that. And it also helps me to remind that the conclusions of a COP is the lowest common denominator. So this is the basics that they could agree on. This is the starting line. And then from there on, we can do a lot more as countries, but also companies, civil society, schools, anyone can show more ambition. And so to keep pushing for that as well. Yeah.
Thank you so much. That was really, really fascinating. And Marion, turning back to you, so you've been involved with civil society activism across the UNFCCC processes. And one of the really interesting outcomes of SB 58 was that fossil fuel lobbyists will have to self-identify at COP28. And I'm curious of what do you think the implications of this are for future conflicts of interest between the UNFCCC and major oil and gas companies, particularly taking into account, obviously, the COP28 president who is from the oil sector?
Yeah, I'm really lucky because when I was in Bonn, I had the chance to talk with one of Youngal's members who was part of the negotiation process and trying to advocate for this. And they told me that, you know, the goal is the conflict of interest. And what we have now is people are asked now to show their affiliation. I think there is a kind of a big difference between just saying your affiliation and one of conflict of interest. Because in this sense, someone that is part of an oil company might choose which affiliation can put on the badge, because this is the point that now you have who gave you the badge and supposedly who paid for you. But signing something that is a conflict of interest, I think, is the ultimate goal that we want to have in these spaces, where we see everyone that is coming there. Out of those, last year there were 40,000 people. Out of those 40,000 people, how many of them were actually there not to limit the impact of climate change and find a solution, but to, you know, make business and continue the status quo that we have. But it's definitely a quite a big step, considering that so far we didn't have anything. But I think there's still a lot to, you know, a lot to do to get there and to fully have transparency. And the ultimate goal is not just to see who's coming in those spaces, but also to kick polluters out. Because I think, and even very famous people are starting now to, that have been involved in those processes for years and years, I don't want to name any of them, so I'm not wrong. They've been, you know, on the side of, oh, we need to engage with fossil fuels, we need to have them at the table. And now they've realized that those people actually, and those companies, they have not invested as they promised, they have not done as much as they said in their campaigns, their greenwashing campaigns that they are going to do. And now they realize that it's not going to happen if we keep on having them at the table. And they're saying, yeah, we will continue to, you know, invest and make this as fast as possible. And then when you look at the numbers, when you look at, for example, the banking of climate chaos, there's a really nice report. You see that the numbers, they've been slightly the same, that like the banks investing in fossil fuels in the past 7 years from Paris Agreement till now, and you're seeing like, okay, so there's no difference from 2015 to 2023, and we're already having like almost 10 years of Paris Agreement. I think the ultimate goal is, after having full transparency and trying to limit their participation, and eventually having them restricted participation in key decision-making spaces.
No, brilliant. And I think it's very evident that there is a lot of sort of backdoor lobbying that goes on. And one of the big consequences of this is obviously failing to find a concrete outcome or concrete agreement. And we saw this at SB58 because the agenda for COP28 wasn't finalized until the very end. Would you mind giving us some sort of insight into what this dynamic was like, and sort of particularly what the consequences of it were, especially as they applied to the mitigation work program?
Yeah, I really like that Jessica mentioned the geopolitics, the geopolitical tension. And I think this year I had this like aha moment. Before joining the Bond Climate Change, I was working with Zoe Institute for Future Fit Economies, and I was specifically working on industrial policy. And while I was doing research, I realized how much of the game between the countries, with the USA, with the Inflation Reduction Act, and then the EU immediately started with the Green Deal Industrial Plan. So everything of those, the race for who is actually first and in the green deck, I think is also reflected in this space. Because what we saw is actually that countries started to have less and less trust. And then essentially what is all this about is not just like a race of who's going to be first, but it's also the US being on the side with the EU, and then both of them against China and against Russia. And, you know, this is really building a lot of tension. And we saw this specifically on the agenda, because what was good on one side is that the EU wanted to introduce in the agenda the mitigation work program. So they wanted to continue talking about it, which is a program that they decided last year that is going to happen for 4 years. So they had a first dialogue now on energy, and they wanted to, you know, build a step towards a possible conclusion at next COP. And then what other countries have come up with is that, okay, so if you want to talk about mitigation, then we also want to talk about finance. And I definitely agree with those countries, and this is what we also said in our with Yango when we had like the press conference and when we did the demonstrations, that we don't want to choose between talking about mitigation of reducing emissions and moving very fast towards radical reduction of emissions. We also want to talk about finance, but it doesn't mean that those two have to be in contradiction. but because of this lack of trust, and I understand, like, those developing countries, they have been promised that they're going to receive this 100 billion yearly climate finance, and they have not received it. I mean, the maximum was, I don't know, 70 billion or 80, something like that. So obviously, if they lack the trust, so they want to make sure that if there is more responsibilities on their shoulders, this responsibility also comes with tools to help them navigate this process. But in the end, they've been debating this a lot, which on one hand, using a lot of time to just debate the agenda is definitely not showing any sort of progress. And on the other hand, is that the other delegates, the other party delegates, they continue to go to the negotiations. And most of them, while I was, for example, in the mitigation negotiations, half of them were like, oh, we want to move with this process. And half of them were like, well, we just want to follow the procedure. And the procedure says, if you don't have the agenda, then why would we move forward if we didn't agree on having this on the agenda in the first place? So it was just like, such a frustrating dynamic, considering looking around and seeing the like chaos that we're in, spending this amount of money and effort in just having this heated debate over the agenda was just like very, very frustrating.
No, that sounds really difficult. And Jessica, can I bring you in on the same point? I mean, what was your experience of the agenda fight? And I know Marion sort of began to touch on climate finance, but would you be able to develop that a little bit in this context?
Yes, I think Marianne really mentioned sort of the key elements of what happened. The so-called agenda fight almost becomes like a standard part of these discussions. The first time I was at a COP, I was like so surprised. Oh, how can they not agree on this? And then, yeah, it turns out that this happens at most SBs. But it is, of course, super relevant because if things don't end up on the agenda, the work from the 2 weeks get lost, as what was mentioned, but also there's no conclusion on that item. So that has really big consequences on an item like mitigation work program. And I think it is best understood in this context of climate finance discussions and promises not being met. Also why it turns into a trade-off, because I also agree it shouldn't be a trade-off, but countries are arguing that why should we spend more time thinking about mitigation measures if we do not have the means to actually implement those measures? And we also know that we are not acting enough. So we talked about mitigation and then adaptation with climate finance. A huge amount of that goes to mitigation projects, in part because mitigation projects are often more profitable. So it could be a renewable energy project, for example, and adaptation projects have less return on investment, but we didn't act on mitigation as needed. And so now we are in a phase where we need to adapt to the consequences already there, which brings us to the third bucket of money that we are trying to gather, which is for loss and damage, because we also did not act to adapt in time. And so things get damaged, then they get lost, and there's only so much you can adapt to. So this is a big part of the dynamic and the conversations that you see happening. The 100 billion was mentioned. You're right, it was only 80 billion that was reached in 2020. There's also a two-year gap in reporting on that finance. So we do not know, for example, what was the end amount last year. So it's also very hard to keep countries accountable for their promises if you are not really sure where you are and what you are measuring. One discussion that is going to finalize at COP28 that I'm very interested in is the discussion about a new collective quantified goal, NCQG, for fancy UNFCCC language. And that should be the finance goal after 2025. And here there's also a discussion about whether we could put already targets on the specific things that we want to finance. So mitigation, adaptation, loss and damage for now is a separate agenda item. But to make that more clear, and just to conclude on that, we also know that 100 billion will do nothing to actually tackle the climate crisis. It is not enough money. So we need to be far more ambitious. And in the end, it ties back to who caused it, who is responsible, who should step up. And that keeps on being a really, really hard discussion that you can see reflecting back to you in these agenda fights every time.
Now, if you allow me, I wanted to touch a little bit more on this, of what happens at the subsidiary bodies. Because, for example, we mentioned the mitigation work program, and I just realized I didn't give like a proper context of it. So it's a program that they wanted to, sort of the objective of this program was to urgently scale up mitigation ambition and implementation. So people might ask, okay, so they already decided this at COP27, what is actually to be done? So they had this first dialogue, and what is very unbelievable is they had the first dialogue of on energy, and instead of really having this opportunity of like discussing what the conclusions from this dialogue happened, and also to build on, okay, so how we actually, or maybe even decide what's the second dialogue, because we don't know that it's going to happen in autumn, but we have no idea what's the second dialogue. And also just the build on, yes, we have these dialogues, but where is actually the work that we need to do in order to create a roadmap towards really reducing emissions. And many of the submissions, because we also submit in topic discussions, and Yango submitted one, we specifically mentioned of how is that, like how to include, fossil fuel phase out in that, and how do we get there? And also to include sectors such as agriculture that, yes, has one specific element within the UNFCCC. It has the it's called Sharm el-Sheikh Climate Action on Agriculture and Food Security. But how is that connected towards reducing emissions is not really that much connected. And it's more just connected to how we ensure food security. So I think that they lost an opportunity of really underlying the urgency of like acting and finding solutions. And it got postponed to, yeah, we're just going to discuss about this when we also have the second dialogue, and we're just going to look into it retrospectively. And I think that's really, really disappointing.
No, I think that's the sort of frustration that people are feeling more and more, that even when commitments are sort of put out, there's so little follow through. And sort of building on that, one of the things that hopefully is going to deliver that follow through, but remains to be seen, is of course the conclusion of the first global stocktake at COP28 to assess basically how much progress we've made since the 2015 Paris Agreement. And Jessica, I'm sort of interested, do you think this is actually a serious opportunity for a turning point? You know, do you think this will lead to greater action, or is it just sort of reinforcing these same structures that we see over and over again?
I think that's a really good question, and quite a hard one maybe to answer. But for sure, it will provide a lot of tools and like measurements, like I said, to hold governments accountable. So you all promised to do this thing under the Paris Agreement. This is how far you got. You need to do a lot better. It will not automatically turn into great climate policy, of course. So there's a lot of work to be done. But I do think that sort of setting these goalposts and then holding governments accountable can really help. An example is we all unconsciously know the global goal on mitigation, because that is to stay below 1.5 degrees. This is really, really significant. There is still no global goal on adaptation. This is also one of the agenda items under negotiation. So to set up a framework, what do we actually mean by getting there on adaptation? What does that mean? And only from there on, we can see if we are actually doing well or not. And we are 3 decades into these negotiations, and we do not have the global goal on adaptation. So I do think that can be really helpful, and that would be the entire global stocktake process.
No, thank you so much. And then sort of turning back to the kind of, or turning forward to the future, I suppose. Marion, in a very ideal world, what are you hoping to see come out of COP28? What would be a sort of significant landmark that could allow you to sort of say that that was a success?
I think considering now that the legitimacy of the presidency is very much put into question with the conflict of interest, and also just looking on the website, you're seeing that COP28 is like a legit business opportunity. You open the page and you see like how to get with a private jet to the conference. So having this whole context of you're like, are we really going to a climate change conference? Because the people and the context is not really giving this feeling. So having this whole context, I would really be surprised and have like a piece of hope seeing at least maybe a development, a beginning of a discussion on the development of the Fossil Fuel Non-Proliferation Treaty that would say, even in this context, even when the president is a former, or I'm not even sure he's still the CEO of an oil and gas company, we do have this discussion and this like negotiation starting, and we are seeing it becoming reality that we do want to put an end to fossil fuel. Because he came to the subsidiary bodies and he said something about phasing down fossil fuels. And I think I see a lot of politicians, they started to use the words that we are using, but not really in the context that we want to, because fossil fuel phasing down cannot happen without phasing out. So phasing down, I think, is the road, and it ensures us that we have a just transition, that we need to like slowly decrease, slowly in a very fast way, I would say. But the end goal is to ultimately not have this system that is deeply connected to fossil fuels. And I think it's very like, you know, finally saying, yeah, phasing down. But I think in his perspective and in the perspective of those oil companies and other governments that are not taking climate change seriously, is that they want to use the resources and exploit the resources as much as possible to their benefit. And somewhere in the future, you know, 2050 net zero, perhaps consider the real alternative of like green and clean energy. So yeah, I would be really surprised, and ideally I would see, you know, like a covered decision saying governments agree on developing the Fossil Fuel Non-Proliferation Treaty in this specific timeline of 1-2 years, you know. But I don't think it's going to happen.
Yeah, no, that comes back, I mean, somewhat to what we're talking about, all the fossil fuel lobbyists that are there and all of the sort of background deals and discussions that go on with a massive lack of transparency. But obviously, and probably thankfully, COP and the UNFCCC is only a sort of small part of global climate action. So Jessica, to sort of end this conversation off, would you mind sort of giving us an idea of what are the kind of potential opportunities outside of this process to sort of take action and really engage?
Yes, absolutely. So one other process that I think has a huge potential is the quest for an ambitious advisory opinion from the International Court of Justice. This is essentially legal advice from the highest courts in the world on climate change and human rights. The idea for the advisory opinion on climate change came from Pacific Island students, specifically a classroom full of law students that learned what an advisory opinion was and recognized that could be a great opportunity and tool in the fight against climate change. So this group, Pacific Island Students Fighting Climate Change, campaigned for over 4 years. First, they reached out to the government of Vanuatu, because you need a government on UN level to actually take this forward. And they did so on the diplomatic level and campaign with other member states. And Pacific Island students also reached out to youth around the world. And this resulted in World Youth for Climate Justice, the group that I'm also part of. And so after years of campaigning, both by Vanuatu and by these youth groups, a resolution passed in March on UN General Assembly level that stated that member states are requesting this advisory opinion. So that's really, really good news and a really great opportunity. And this opinion will answer questions about the legal obligations of states towards each other, but also towards their current and future populations when it comes to climate change, and also what the consequences are when they do not actually fulfill those obligations. So we are now in the next steps of this campaign, and we know that the advisory opinion will come from the ICJ, and we need to make it as ambitious as possible so that it can have a huge impact. All member states have been invited to make contributions to this process and to share their views on those questions that the court will answer. So Pacific Island Students Fighting Climate Change and World Youth for Climate Justice have put together a handbook with the main progressive legal arguments that would strengthen this advice. And at the SBs, I also made an effort to talk to as many states as possible, other young people, civil society, to inform them of the opportunity and to hope that people will take the handbook and use that in this process. So that's a really great opportunity coming up.
Thank Thank you so much. And thank you both for sharing sort of some of your insights and taking the time to join us today. I learned a lot about both the process and the experience, and I'm sure everyone else listening did as well. We've now got our GCE COP28 coordinator, Penny, here, who's going to share a bit of what our activities will look like sort of from now into the run-up to COP28.
Hello, all. It's great to be with you today. In anticipation of our presence at COP28 in the UAE this November and December, our team is planning a variety of events, initiatives, and outreach efforts for the months leading up to the conference. SB58 was a key precursor to that, as was seen in the insights Marianne and Jessica just provided, and we will see these conversations continue on our road to COP. There are a multitude of topics needing to be addressed and many challenges built into the process. Coming up soon, we can look for virtual initiatives on climate justice and systems thinking, as well as some other COP-themed projects to come. The team has an ambitious year ahead of us, packed with opportunities to engage and learn from one another, so I encourage everyone to tune in. For those of you listening, if you're interested in keeping up to date with GCE's work in the run-up to COP28 and what we'll be up to, you can read more about our activities at Generation Climate Europe on our website, gceeurope.org/COP, and our social media on Instagram, Facebook, LinkedIn, and Twitter. Additionally, we have a newsletter that you can subscribe to on our website, so check that out.
Brilliant. Thank you so much. And all three of you, thanks again for taking the time to be with us today. And I hope we will hear from you all soon.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.